Welcome to Pomegranate Health. I'm Mick Cabazzini. Before we start the show, an invite to any members of the RACP keen to provide advice on development of the podcast. We need avid listeners to help advise on future topics, suggest experts to interview, and provide feedback on audio before each episode is published. All this occurs by email, and it's not a huge commitment of time. Please go to the website for more information about the application process, which ends mid-January. Now onto the story. This is the first of two episodes about diagnostic reasoning. Compared to maths or physics, diagnostic problems are described as ill-structured because information isn't readily available. The problem can keep changing, and often you're not certain you've reached a solution and are free to stop searching. Diagnostic errors are most common in general practice, internal medicine, and emergency medicine. This is unsurprising given that these are the areas where the most undifferentiated patients present. Misdiagnosis or delayed diagnosis occurs in 10 to 15% of acute presentations, although fortunately only a tenth of these lead to serious consequences for the patient. But this figure hasn't budged in three decades, despite progress in other clinical areas. In the next episode, we'll look at the design and workflow problems that might explain this fact. But today we'll talk about the cognitive biases that can derail logical reasoning for the individual clinician. For this, I went to Auckland to meet two physicians who have an entire podcast series on this very subject called I Am Reasoning.
So my name is Nick Sheckett. I am a general internist. I trained in Toronto, Canada, and I've been living in New Zealand now for 7 years. And passion is medical education and clinical reasoning.
I'm Art Nahil. I trained as a general internist in Boston and moved to New Zealand 12 years ago with my Kiwi wife and two children, and have been for the last several years director of medical education here within general medicine. I also do lots of creative writing, so that's me.
Before we begin, maybe just explain why you felt the need to start your own podcast about diagnostic reasoning.
Well, I think in large part it's because differential diagnosis building is a skill that is not taught very well at all, even in current modern day medical schools. And many of us, myself included, floundered for many, many years unnecessarily, thinking that we were stupid, that we just didn't have what it took to be a good doctor, when really what it took was a system to develop differential diagnoses.
Okay, let's start with some cognitive psychology. The theory goes that all the conditions you've studied or had experience of are schematized in your long-term memory as a library of illness scripts. Then the case presentation before you triggers recall of a handful of scripts that might match that same pattern. As a clinician becomes more experienced, they have a more varied library of illness scripts to call upon. Occasionally, a physician will miss a diagnosis of some rare disease because that unique script was missing from their library. But most diagnostic areas actually involve misdiagnosis of common diseases. So what does this say about the nature of the cognitive problem?
Well, common diseases often present uncommonly, and that's where the errors come in. You know, when we're trained in medical school, we tend to have disease-specific illness scripts. So congestive heart failure presents in this way. Pulmonary embolus presents in this way. But when somebody presents to ED, for example, they don't come and say, "Doctor, I've got heart failure." Right, they come with shortness of breath. When we get out and we begin to practice, we realize that we need to refile our illness scripts so they are filed under presentations.
It's almost like the more experience you get, the more you're able to cross-reference these markers.
That's exactly what it is. We develop a system of cross-referencing that's much more sophisticated as we gain experience.
On that same idea that you've raised, Art, studies over many years show that it's always the same handful of conditions which are missed. Pulmonary embolism, drug reactions, acute coronary syndrome, and certain malignancies. It's such a varied list of conditions. What do they have in common is that they can present very subtly or across a spectrum.
But I think that gets to what Art was saying, is that if an acute coronary syndrome or acute myocardial infarction presents as 60-year-old male with a history of diabetes, presents with crushing retrosternal chest pain, shortness of breath, you know, and collapse or, you know, something like that, the acute MI is not going to get missed in those situations. It's when it presents as, you know, vague epigastric pain or
shoulder pain or nausea and vomiting. Yeah.
And so if we could get people to recognize more automatically that whenever you see someone who presents with shoulder pain, you should think, on top of other, you know, diagnoses, you should think maybe it's an MI.
There was a nice example you gave in one of your podcasts about in order to slow yourself down, you sort of do that miniaturization, fly through the body and go, okay, there's this system, there's the skeletal system, there's a bit.
I think that's where I referred to the magic school bus.
Doing it, yeah, doing it quickly.
Well, sure. So when we're teaching fourth-year medical students or even some of our juniors, they've never really been taught any formal way or formal structures to use when they're trying to come up with a differential diagnosis. They oftentimes don't even know where to begin. And so most of them rely on acronyms. I don't use acronyms. I can't remember what they all stand for. So for something like shortness of breath, which is very undifferentiated, both Nick and I suggest that people think first of a systems approach, and then within that system, begin to think anatomically. I sort of start on the outside, and I work my way in very deliberately to the inside. So I think about, for the respiratory system, the outermost part being the chest wall, then there's the pleura, the pleural space, the alveoli, the interstitium, the airways, both small and large, the vasculature. And I think very, very simply, what can go wrong pathophysiologically with those things that could cause somebody to feel short of breath? Again, they don't have to explore all of them, but it at least gives them something that they could potentially use when they're facing an undifferentiated symptom.
A prevalent model in cognitive psychology is the dual process theory, popularized by the book Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman. Fast thinking is known as System 1. It's said to involve subconscious pattern recognition strategies and is shaped by a lifetime of associative memory. But jumping to conclusion based on these intuitions can lead to cognitive error. By contrast, System 2 thinking is more methodical and rational. It takes time and cognitive effort to work through, however, so we end up using System 1 thinking 90% of the time. I asked Nick Sheckett to share his gunslinger analogy of these two systems.
System one, in the gunslinger analogy, system one would be the guy who shoots from the hip, you know, big shotgun, first thing that moves, shoots from the hip, fires. Whereas system two would be the sniper. So, you know, takes into account the distance, the wind speed, the movement, uses careful calibration, and doesn't actually fire until, you know, they've thought about it more carefully.
But it takes time to set that up.
It does, yeah.
And the two systems we're talking about, it's not just pop psychology and black boxes. There's good evidence from fMRI studies and behavioral testing that different neural pathways exist. And diagnostic reasoning involves a constant ebb and flow between these two processes. But when intuition leads us to ignore important information, that's what we call cognitive bias. And Gurpreet Dhaliwal, who you interviewed recently, reminds us in the BMJ that heuristics are not a bug in our neural software. They're an essential feature of the program. The vocabulary of bias makes us forget that they work most of the time. Is that a fair?
Yeah, I think system one thinking gets a bad rap, to be honest. You know, we spend most of our time in it because it's so efficient and it's usually right. And evolutionarily, we probably wouldn't have developed such a dependence upon system one if it was a horrible failure. It's just that when you're dealing with medicine and people's lives and illness, you want to try to, you know, bypass all of those built-in little glitches in the system. But the system generally works pretty well.
When you're escaping saber-toothed tigers,
it works great,
that's,
right?
That's why
you don't want to sit there and debate, you know, is that animal with the large fangs and the spots, does that really look like a...
This footprint could be a large
cat. You just want to react and you want to do it quickly.
I don't know. I think the division between one and two is probably not as clear as we make it out to be. It's a model to think about the different processes, but we may not be able to ever separate what's actually happening from minute to minute.
One study examined the types of diagnostic errors made by junior doctors, senior residents, and consultants in admissions to a neurology ward. And as you'd expect, errors resulting from poor examination technique or what they called an inadequate fund of knowledge became less frequent over the career. But errors in diagnostic reasoning were still significant in more experienced clinicians. Does that mean you can't unlearn these traps of cognitive reasoning?
This is actually something that's being discussed fairly regularly by, you know, all the people that do research in this area. You know, one camp saying it's worth knowing about these traps and learning about them and trying to protect yourself from them. And there's another camp that says it has nothing to, you know, that's not going to work. And one of the points that we made recently was that it was worth knowing about them, maybe not to try and avoid yourself falling into the traps, but in order to identify them in your colleagues and peers. And if you truly have a collaborative model of practice where you can speak to your peers without the fear of criticism, then knowing about these traps can serve in a group practice.
A cognitive bias is an irrational or illogical blip in reasoning. There are names for about 100 different biases, and here we'll talk about a few of the most important. For example, premature closure occurs when a clinician locks down on an attractive diagnosis before all the evidence is in, and before alternative diagnoses are excluded. In one study where junior doctors were presented with written case studies, 53 out of the 58 subjects made this cognitive error in at least one of the three scenarios. Premature closure is often discussed alongside search satisficing.
Search satisficing specifically refers to stopping to look for something else because you've already found something that explains the presentation. So someone comes in with, you know, the classic that we love. Someone comes in with delirium or confusion. You find that the urine is infected, and so you stop looking for other causes of confusion, even though the urine being infected could have been happening at the same time as something else.
And you've missed the subdural hematoma or something because you stopped at the urinary tract infection.
Yeah, which, to unpack the etymology, that diagnosis suffices to explain the test result and your cursory glance of this presentation, the delirium, but you're satisfied that you made the right call.
Yeah, but, and the fact that you're satisfied doesn't actually mean that you've satisfied all the explanations. Because often when you do go back and look at those cases, you often could ask the question, well, but then how do you explain the unilateral weakness, for example? And so often in these cases, if you go back and you find out if they have in fact satisfied the presentation, often there's something that's not actually explained well enough by whatever they've chosen.
Or you've stopped searching prematurely. So as an example, there was a study done a number of years ago looking at radiologists and the diagnoses that they made. And they actually had x-rays that they showed to a number of radiologists which had both a large lung mass and a comminuted fracture of the clavicle. And I think, if I remember the study correctly, up to a third of trained radiologists didn't pick up on the comminuted fracture of the clavicle because they saw the big lung mass and cognitively moved on to the next problem.
Now, Pat Croskery, who's the director of the critical thinking program at Dalhousie University, Pat Croskery uses the term cognitive forcing strategies for techniques that snap us out of that system one thinking. Sort of questions you ask yourself to slow down the decision-making process and consider the steps more rationally. Is this the kind of process that you go through when?
Well, we certainly emphasize that when we're teaching juniors, and we try to model it as well, because I typically have a quick set of questions that I try to ask. And I specifically ask them when the case seems like a slam dunk. So that's when I find that it's most important to ask these questions, not with the really difficult ones where you're sort of struggling and it doesn't seem to fit anything in particular, because
in those cases, you're already
in system two.
Right.
You're already there. So try to remember always to ask the questions, what else could it be? What's the worst thing it could be? What do I not want to miss? Is there anything about this that doesn't fit? And I think that's really a key question to ask. Are there any bits of the presentation or the investigations that don't fit? So we frequently, for example, will see somebody coming in with quote-unquote pyelonephritis, but their urine is actually not that significant, but yet they're treated as a pyelonephritis.
So we've talked about premature closure. A similar error is known as the anchoring heuristic. Nick, can you explain this one?
Anchoring is slightly different in that for whatever reason you've decided on a certain diagnosis and you just become attached to it and enamored with it and you don't want to let it go. It's like your baby project. So you want to hang on to it. So it doesn't necessarily mean that you made the wrong decision. It doesn't imply what went into making that wrong decision, if it is wrong, but you hang on to it because it's yours.
Yeah, and going back to the processing models, selecting the short list of illness scripts is said to be the most critical stage. And simulation studies in the 80s reveal that if the correct diagnosis wasn't contained in the initial list of, say, 5 or 6 scripts, there was a large chance that the right script was never going to come up. In fact, clinicians presented with a missed diagnosis will often say, "I just didn't think of it." Is that because you're more likely to hover around the incorrect scripts you've pulled up, trying to make them fit, rather than going back to scratch and admitting that you missed some important distinguishing feature?
I was going to say, that sounds right. You get anchored. It's one of the biases that we recognize, and anchoring happens within your own mind. So when you think of the 3 or 4 most common things, you're not going to go beyond that most of the time. And if you relay that information in any way through documentation, through handover, whatever it is, to your colleagues, they're also not going to have other things come to mind. We're not doing an exhaustive analysis of the case.
And that's also referred to as diagnostic momentum through the system, or the framing effect.
Yeah, so diagnostic momentum I see as a continuation of anchoring. The difference being that the diagnosis gets anchored from person to person. Framing isn't just purely about handing over a diagnosis and expecting every other team subsequently to continue with that same diagnosis. Framing is the information that you emphasize when you're handing over patients. What you decide to even just mention will affect the way that subsequently people think about that diagnosis, the way that you write a note, and that's going to affect the diagnoses that are elicited in other people's minds.
So one of our juniors did a recent study on the framing effect, and he sent out surveys to emergency room physicians and general physicians, both registrars or residents and consultants or attendings. And in it, there were essentially 2 different scenarios. And one of the scenarios was framed very suggestively for pulmonary embolus. The other one had exactly the same clinical information in it, but was not framed suggestively. And the results were pretty dramatic. So the survey asked people to list the top 3 things on their differential diagnosis and what they would do to investigate it. In the scenario with the framed pulmonary embolus, I think almost all respondents had pulmonary embolus on their differential diagnosis, whereas only, I think, 1/3 in the non-suggested scenario had pulmonary embolus even anywhere on their differential. The second disease was interstitial lung disease. Again, one framed suggestively, one with the same clinical information framed non-suggestively. and the drop-off was remarkable.
Wow. And I could imagine if you've asked a radiologist, you might request some scans to examine a patient's back pain, and then the radiologist, knowing that you're looking for back pain, might see the same usual undistinguishing features but read in more closely and say, yeah, there's a, could be a ruptured disc there or some hypertrophy. It's almost...
That's a difficult tension because you want to avoid ordering, say, a CT scan of an area of the body and say, I'm not going to tell you anything, just tell me what you see. Tell me what you see. That's very difficult. There's so much information there, and you do want to give radiologists a bit of a focus. But I think the best we can do is we can say, the patient has symptoms in this area. Can you tell me what's wrong with that area or what you see in that area?
Cognitive errors are often laced with emotion and ego. Confirmation bias, for example, is the unconscious process of acknowledging only that evidence which supports the preferred working hypothesis. Nick Sheckett says everyone is susceptible to this.
Yeah, I mean, that rings true. I see myself falling into this when I've got a diagnosis in mind that I know what to do with and it would be easier for me to deal with and manage. I really want it to be that diagnosis. And I see myself overemphasizing or underemphasizing clinical features to try and fit. So yeah, you got to stay away from that.
That's a good example, yeah. And I could imagine a physician getting some bloods back for a patient and they're kind of on the edge of the range, but you're looking for a given diagnosis. So you sort of self-fulfilling, you go, oh yeah, they're just over. That's probably, is that an example of confirmation bias as well?
I think it's a form of confirmation bias. Blood work that's sort of on the borderline, you know, those are ones where we oftentimes don't quite know what to do with it. And so they're quite easy to ignore if we want the diagnosis to be X as opposed to Y.
One cognitive forcing strategy that can snap you out of this confirmation bias is called consider the opposite. So deliberately seek evidence to refute your hypothesis rather than to prove it. Is this something you can do sort of seamlessly in that process, Art?
Well, that gets back, if I can just say for a minute, to a scientific philosopher named Karl Popper, who discussed this issue of the black swan. So if you have a hypothesis that all swans are white and all you do is go out looking for white swans, you can never actually prove your theory true. So you actually have to go out looking for the black swans in particular in order to try to prove your theory correct or incorrect.
And we put this into practice on a daily basis. You know, it comes back to that classic pyelonephritis. The first thing, because I become immediately suspicious when I hear certain diagnoses, pyelonephritis is one of them, gastroenteritis.
Bilateral cellulitis.
Bilateral cellulitis for sure. And the first thing that comes into my mind, and I think you operate the same way, Art, is to say, my job this morning is to disprove this theory.
We don't say that to the individual, but
no.
Out loud.
No, that's right.
To the registrar.
No, yeah, we don't want to put anyone off. But in my mind, I'm thinking, my job this morning is to disprove this. And if I can't do that, then it means I'm satisfied with what they've come up with.
And so it doesn't necessarily take any more work to go through that.
No, I would say it does take more
work.
Yeah,
it takes a bit more cognitive work. It does, for sure.
Because the easiest thing to do would be to just say, pyelonephritis, you know, antibiotics. What, you know, I don't have to make any decisions here. Let's move on. Who's the next patient? It definitely takes more work.
And your emotional reaction towards a patient can also affect how you care for them. And we talk about affective or visceral bias. Can you give some examples of this that you've seen?
The common patients that elicit or are at risk for eliciting that kind of bias, you know, are the patients who are alcoholic, obese, chronic pain, patients with mental health issues. And I think one of the reasons, for example, that patients with mental health issues have a much higher mortality and morbidity is because we don't like dealing with them. And so we don't take what they say seriously. We put everything down to mental illness, and we don't like not being able to make diagnoses. So the frequent flyer that has been in before, we also have what's called a yin-yang heuristic, whereby we think, oh, well, they've been in so many times before, they've been worked up the yin-yang. What can I possibly offer in this case? I'm just going to move on. Somebody else has tried this. I'm going to move on. So those patients oftentimes don't get the same cognitive work that patients who aren't frequent flyers get.
One example that we spoke about recently was a patient who was admitted for the 15th time with complications of alcohol intoxication and long-standing alcoholism. And one thing that I asked the team to do after we rounded on that patient was to include in the summary of that patient, in the progress notes every day, to include what that patient did for a living before they fell into trouble. And I think everyone agreed that it changed the way in which that patient was viewed immediately.
Some cognitive errors come from a misplaced gut instinct. Regular exposure to a certain condition, or a particularly memorable example, can make it easier to bring a given illness script to mind. The danger is that this might not match with the relative prevalence of the condition compared to other diagnoses, a reasoning error we call base rate neglect.
Base rate neglect is when people don't take into account the natural rate of occurrence of a particular thing. And so they may tend to underestimate its importance or overestimate its importance.
Maybe where it becomes more important is for rare conditions. As an example, if someone presents with palpitations and headache, you might be tempted to think about something like pheochromocytoma. Extremely rare. In fact, out of every 800 in the States, anyway, out of every 800 people who are investigated with tests for pheochromocytoma, one diagnosis is made. There are many other much more common causes for palpitations and headache, right? And so it could be an arrhythmia, it could be anxiety, it could be dehydration. So that would be an example where base rate neglect is going to lead you down a path that you don't need to go down.
And you might be led down that path by experience of an emotional and a dramatic event. Emotion is a strong driver for forming memories. Everyone remembers where they were on 9/11, but not where they left their car keys. And Gurpreet Dhaliwal gives the example of a patient who presents with a splitting headache. You make the diagnosis that it's a migraine, but it turns out to be a brain tumor. So this, of course, will be a shocking and a memorable event in your career. Now, if he started ordering a head CT in every patient with a headache, he'd, of course, be accused of base rate neglect and over-testing. And the aphorism that sort of reminds us against that is, when you hear hoofbeats, think horses, not zebras.
Except if you're practicing in Africa. and that's what gets to base rate, right? So if you're practicing in Africa, then zebras are more common than horses. And so you have to know that, and you have to know where you're practicing and what the locality is and the prevalence of various things in your locality, which is sometimes difficult, often difficult.
By the way, I can already see a Facebook post from someone correcting. Someone's going to say, actually, Art, there are more horses in Africa, but there are many more zebras than there are in North America.
Right. So the availability of David Attenborough documentaries has made you think. So that little aphorism fits with the fact we mentioned earlier that most misdiagnoses is due to atypical presentations of common conditions rather than rare ones. I find it confusing then when we use the term the availability heuristic. It can also refer to availability because of prevalence. And so the hypothesis that's easily brought to mind is the one you see every day.
So it doesn't just have to be because it's something you see frequently, but it can be availability bias because it just comes to mind for a variety of reasons.
Yeah. It just has to be more available in your mind. You know, people see a cool factor of diagnosing something rare like pheochromocytoma. So all of a sudden they want it to be that when there are much more common explanations.
But occasionally they are diagnosed. And yes, that's where the difficulty.
Yeah, and Pat Crosskey describes a cognitive forcing strategy called ROWS, or ROSE, for rule out worst case scenario. When would you employ that approach, and when are you over-testing? In the headache example described earlier, you're not going to order a CT on every patient, are you?
If this patient, for example, is 70 years old and has never had a migraine, well, then I'm loath to make the diagnosis of it being a migraine headache. If somebody has had a long history of migraines and they say, yep, this feels a bit like my migraine, and I go through my, what's the worst it can be? Is there anything here that doesn't fit? And I'm satisfied that I don't need to do anything else, well, then I will go with migraine. I don't think, if you look at my data, I don't think I utilize CTs or labs any more than anyone else in our department. So I think despite going through this process, I don't think it necessarily leads to higher utilization.
Because Dhaliwal compares this to a football coach who makes a high-risk play, and depending on the outcome, it will be variously described as heroic and strategic, or alternatively short-sighted and reckless. Without hindsight, can you tell the difference between a brilliant diagnostician and someone who's being paranoid?
People that come to mind when you say brilliant diagnostician are famous people like William Osler, or, you know, I dare put Gurpreet Dhaliwal in the same sentence. He has so many illness scripts. He has such an amazing associative memory. But for the rest of us mortals, brilliant would mean taking the time and the care to consider all the other diagnoses and having a rational approach to reaching the final diagnosis.
So the brilliant diagnostician, I think, is oftentimes the very confident one. So who comes in, makes a diagnosis, drops the mic, walks out. But we shouldn't make diagnoses about heroism. It should be about reproducible, accurate, reliable information. We interviewed Larry Weed, who is a pretty prominent figure in medicine, or was until his recent death. He oftentimes said that being a physician is not about brilliance. It's about how you manage data. And I think that there's a lot of truth to that.
Thanks to Art Nahil and Nick Sheckett for joining this episode of Pomegranate Health. The views expressed are their own and may not represent those of the Royal Australasian College of Physicians. There are another 15 minutes of outtakes from this interview at our website, including a case study to test your ability to pick heuristics in diagnostic reasoning. This comes from an online QStream workshop that the college is running from April 18th. Registrations open a month beforehand. At the web address racp.edu.au/pomcast, you'll also find articles mentioned in this story and a few other recommended podcasts. I Am Reasoning has interviews with Gurpreet Dhaliwal and Larry Weed, and lots more challenging case studies. At the Canadian podcast Emergency Medicine Cases, there is also some great discussion about decision-making and de-biasing. Please add your comments to the website to continue this discussion, and subscribe to Pomegranate Health using any podcasting app. The second episode of this story will be released in February and deals with systems problems that contribute to diagnostic error. But next month we take on medicinal cannabis. I'm Mick Cavazzini. Thanks for listening.